Welcome to Zooming in the Lens podcast. I'm Katrina, and this is part two with somebody very special. Part two with Brian Clark. Brian is an entrepreneur, coach, a practitioner, a facilitator and practitioner of the work of Byron Katie, and many, many other things. This is a very talented guy, and he was also our participant in my online course I do with Ram Dass called Zooming in the Lens online course. Hopefully you've listened to part one. What part two is continuing on from is the last thing that was talked about, and that was about his parents' reaction to being gay. What's it like to be in the spiritual world, a practitioner, a teacher, a kid when he was younger, and to have to sort through all these feelings of something that might feel like it separates you so much more than you feel like you can handle. I don't think separation is really has any place in spirituality, but with a challenge like being homosexual, lesbian, or just plain different than the average statistics of what our culture and our world says today, it can be quite challenging without a spiritual practice. And sometimes a spiritual practice comes along and it could be the only lifeline you have. So here we go with part two with Brian Clark, who's been so gracious to let us into his world and let us take some questions from people about how all of this played out for him within his life as a child, growing up, and now in adulthood, being so well versed in coaching for adversity. So here's part two with Brian Clark. And to reach Brian, go to clientclarity.com. Thank you very much. Enjoy part two. And how tight the spacesuit must have been. And then your father finds out and he's angry. So now you're finding out that your spacesuit ain't so great. And how does that play out in your life?
You know, you said earlier that people, you know, the don't know mind, and that's like a good space to be in, and you and I know that. Yeah. But a lot of people say that they're afraid of the unknown. So I think this gets mixed up because What do you mean? I should not know, but I'm afraid of the unknown. So they're kind of caught in between there.
Why don't you point out a lot of the things that they think they know that they don't know?
Yeah. And working with people's belief systems, I realized that it's impossible to fear the unknown. What you fear is what you imagine is going to happen in that space. So if you're afraid of the dark, you're really more afraid of the imaginary monster under your bed or in your closet than you are of the dark itself. Nobody's afraid of the darkness. Yeah. Never hurt anyone. Yeah. It's the stuff that's hiding and lurking in it. And so, first of all, to me, you know, talking about going to hell for being gay, I was in hell mentally. I think when you believe your stressful thoughts, you're in hell. Absolutely. You're there. That's my interpretation now of things. But at the time, you know, all of my fears of the unknown were, you know, about I wasn't going to be supported when I came out. And so I think...
And you weren't.
What's that?
And you weren't.
Well, I believe we're always supported, just not in the ways that we anticipate.
Exactly.
Or we are aware of. You can't not be supported, but you... in certain ways, I wasn't.
What does that mean? Like, translate that.
I just noticed that I, you know, don't do anything to be alive right here sitting with you. I'm breathing. I'm not, I'm not counting my breaths. I'm not working them all out. I'm not pumping my own blood. It's just all sort of given.
Right.
So, and so, yeah, I don't really, you know, I'm supported just by God or whatever you want to call the universe or reality or, you know, that's where I'm held. We're all held by reality, but we don't believe it. We believe our imagination more than we believe reality. So we give more credence to those images in our head and we can't see what's right under our noses. And that's like denial, basically, is believing that something untrue is truer than reality. And so, you know, it did affect, I think I had a big, that, I don't know if that was the start of it. I don't think necessarily it was the start of it, of my fear of abandonment, but that was a big, big milestone in my fear of abandonment, or a big moment. I know when I was younger, I think I was 6 years old, and my best friend who lived across the street, it was a parsonage, and his dad got assigned to another church, and so we had been friends growing up, and at age 6 or 7, he had to move away. And that was probably my first experience of, or maybe not my first, I mean, I've lost pets and things, but fear of abandonment really showed up when I came out. And so I carried that need to protect myself into my relationships. And not just my personal relationship. I took it to my friendships, took it to my love relationships, my business relationships. This client doesn't really want to sign up.
Right.
Or they won't do it, or whatever it was. And so I'm not blaming parents for this or anything.
No.
But it's like that experience did affect the course of my life then, in terms of just, you know, I was always interested, like you mentioned earlier, I was always fascinated by the mind, and my dad introduced me to things like ESP and hypnosis. There were books in the attic and stuff, and I got into all that. There was a yoga book too. I never got into that though.
Oh.
But like actual, some of it was pretty crazy, like, you know, sticking a rope in your nose and pulling out your mouth.
Yeah.
That didn't appeal. Maybe that's what turned me off from yoga.
Right.
But so I was always fascinated by like understanding my, like, self-realization is what I'd call it now. And when I discovered Eckhart Tolle and the work of Byron Katie as a practice, really, the Byron Katie work really helped me to, you know, when I was younger, I always wanted to take things apart and figure out how they worked. So the work of Byron Katie helps me take apart my mind and see how it works. I get to see those parts that are, those subconscious parts and things that are, you know, the little cogs in the wheel, and to really see what are they doing. And
how does it stop you from, like, how does it build you back up then? Because it takes you apart, but like, I worry about that, because then it doesn't put you back together, or what?
But, you know, it's not like Humpty Dumpty so much. a quote of Byron Katie's, that I like, is that every story leads away from you.
What does that mean?
Basically, you are not, it's like the Tao Te Ching I just said earlier, it's who you believe you to be isn't who you are.
Right.
So,
who are every, we?
Say it again.
Who are we?
Well, you are who you believe you to be in the moment. And
but if I want to believe that I'm a millionaire, but I'm not,
well, maybe you have the spirit of one, I don't know. But you are what you believe yourself. You don't believe yourself to be a millionaire. I hear you fantasize about it, but you don't believe it. Unless you are one, then the proof's there in your bank account. But so if you, it's not about let's pretend. It's more about taking what you believe is real and peeling back the onion and realizing, oh, I thought that was me. Oops, not that, not that, not that.
Right.
And then that gets replaced with, I am that, I am that, I am that. So it's kind of like you determine what you're not. It's almost process of elimination at first. And then there's that common thread that runs through it all that I would say is what you are, is that essence, which I can't put really, no words would do no justice words. To.
Yeah.
So whatever that common denominator that goes through all these self-inquiries, I once did ask Byron Katie, I said, what's asking the questions of, there's four questions to the work. What's asking these questions when you're doing self-inquiry? And her response was nothing. And that made sense to me at the time.
Right.
But before then, I would have thought she was a kook. But yeah, that nothingness, that no identity, or the identity of the world, you could even say that everything you see, you know, it's like you begin to realize that everything I judge, everything I experience comes from my story of what it is. So it's me. Everything's me.
Mm-hmm.
So you, to me, are the Katrina of my story.
Mm-hmm.
But to yourself, you have your own story running. And so that's what's funny about all this is we're running around this
world. We may both be wrong.
Yeah, we're both wrong, too. That's the funny part, right? Or most likely. And so the 8 billion of us living in our own private worlds, trying to collide with other planets, basically, of people. You know, it's like we're clashing in different ways. But somehow, at some point, our society, or humans, really, at some point must have figured out that different is wrong.
Well, I think we're cultivating something that we feel we have some control over or can get it. That's the big giant misfortune or misguidedness of it. So we're all trained in the ego structure.
Yeah.
And we build upon that. And so, okay, 10 people say, when you're young, start building your 401k. And 10 other people come along and they see that they're doing it. Maybe 5 will. And then those 5 turn into 15. Those 10 and the 5 turn into 15. And it keeps growing and it keeps growing and it keeps growing. And nobody's ever asked how many people actually get to spend their 401k because they've survived long enough. When is the right time to cash in your 401k? And by the time you do, are you even physically able to do what you intended to do when you started to save your 401k, which, you know, hypothetically could have been traveling around the world, but now you're 70 and maybe you're not in as great a shape as you would have hoped. And so you have the money, but you don't have the ability because of physical circumstances. So that's just one example of the train that takes off. And our whole culture is built on this ego structure. And it's because we are training in controlling what we can, that we can, you know, we grow up and believe that everything can be controlled too. And when it's not controlled, we're shocked. I mean, we all know we're going to die. I don't know what age you realized you were going to die or death was even an available word for you.
A story, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't even remember, but I remember first finding out, and I would have rather have found out a different way. I would have not rather have found out the way that I found out because it was an in the moment when somebody died. And the shock is what gripped me for 20 years after that. Not even the actuality of it. I think the shock that we don't have control over majority of the things that we're taught we have control over is part of what you do and part of what I do in our own practices. I'm not even talking about teaching it. in our own practices of discovering, wow, I thought that I can at least control that, or I thought I could at least control who I date, or I thought I could at least control what car I get, or nope. To come to realize that it's not really about control at all in any way, but to get people to get ourselves to look at the belief systems and see the stories, I always just return to when the student arrives, the teacher appears. Because if that part of us is not ready for that, we just will not get there. It won't even be an option. So it's not right for everybody. Can I wish in my mind that it would be? Only because my belief that I'm working off of is that we would all stop trying to make everybody the same. I wouldn't look to Brian and say, why are you gay? You're gonna, if you don't have kids, then human population is gonna go down, or whatever it is, you know, like there's not enough kids that need parents. Yeah. You know what I mean? But we don't think that deeply into it because we believe that we are our spacesuit. We believe we're our beliefs. And so what we're asking through spirituality and the work is that you question who you are, even though we're not questioning who you are. That's not our business.
Growing up, that's what I think I noticed the most, was that due to society and the things I heard, whether or not I identified with it, as I was constantly questioning myself, like I was self-aware in that way, like questioning myself, questioning my right or wrongness.
Well, that's a different kind of questioning. Yeah. That's the questioning. Yeah,
or just trying to figure me out somehow. Like,
yeah.
Why do I get upset by hearing that Bible verse or whatever? I think that, you know, I've never met a single person who hasn't had the thought, there's something wrong with me.
Oh my God, yeah.
And I like to twist that around and say, that's the most honest thought, mm-hmm. if you consider who's saying it.
Right. Exactly.
There's something wrong with the ego.
Absolutely.
Because it can't stand on its own two feet. It has to create.
Yeah.
It has to come up with all these stories to create its existence, and then it has to hold it up with all these lies. And the lies, unfortunately, are what we accept as truth, typically. Right. In reality, as people would call it, you know, like,
yeah,
the common reality that the cultures will tell you is real. And doing spiritual work, I discovered there was a more real reality.
Well, yeah, and I think it's also important to say that you may want to rip the blanket out quickly, or you may want to titrate it and slowly pull the blanket out. That's why I think every student arrives in the place that they're in. And it's not, I think what changed for me is understanding that my life in my spacesuit is just as important and worthy as my soul or my atman, my true self. I started out forsaking that. I started out saying I need to shed, you know, Katrina 2, and the mind is bad and I need to control it, or I need to quiet it. And the only dialogue I ever heard back from that was, I can't quiet my mind. I can't sit and meditate. I can't. And what also was accomplished from that thinking process too, was that the questioning of my beliefs and my thoughts, they were staying as the mind questioning the mind. And that got me deeper into a hole.
So it was more intellectual for you then?
It wasn't intellectual. I thought it was. So I went down that journey for a little while. What it ended up was the cultivation of the witness. It's where I can identify myself as nature, myself in the tree, in the wall, anything. I mean, listen, I'll say this, that yes, I understand that a tree might be alive to some people, but a wall is definitely not to a lot of people. But if the wall is got wood in it, that wood came from something called a tree, and that tree was once, that wood was once a part of the tree. You and I are considering death in our humanness, in our twos. We're considering death, that when you chop down the tree, it dies because it seems to stop growing. But I widen my perspective on that and say that I don't know that to be totally true. I know that our organism, if you chop off certain parts of us, we cannot live. But you and I, and most of the people listening, know that if my arm gets chopped off, it doesn't mean I'm going to die. If I can suture the wound and stop the bleeding. So how do I know that by chopping down a tree, that that wood that's laying on the ground separate from the roots now is actually dead? That wood you take from the ground and then put into your walls. I'm just trying to entertain the mind here for a second to say that there are so many perspectives, but thinking you know it all and thinking that the minute you end something, something else has to start. We're all running simultaneous. We're all alive and dead. The minute you're born, you're dying. And the minute you're born, you're living. So to walk around chasing away religious beliefs because they're dogmatic and dualistic, you're walking duality. Because you're both dying and living all at the same time. And when you don't know something, you have room to broaden and find yourself in spaces where there is, you are part of nature. And I really feel like I'm swimming in that place of, in being part of nature, I am both as alive and as dead as that wood in my wall. If I choose to not respect that wall and not respect that wood and not respect its aliveness and its death both at the same time, my thinking is going to be very linear. In that perspective, if I meditate or do something that wakes me up, I'm putting that in quotes, wakes me up to things outside of the me, my, and I can sense that there is this ability in the human predicament to both witness my thought and think the thought. And in the witnessing of the thought, I am creating space from being the thought alone. Now I can pop back and forth. Like I'm popping back and forth from being, I'm almost dead and I'm almost fully alive. All at the same time. I'm thinking the thought and I'm cultivating the witness of the thought. And then when the witness is gone, I find myself back in the thought of he didn't call. Oh, wake up. Boom. I'm the wall again. I'm the wood in the wall again. And creating that space allows me to witness the thought and investigate from the witness. And that's what spirituality, I feel, is cultivating the heart space. Because if you're not the witness and you're not the thought, it's nice to find a nice, comfy, safe home in the heart, metaphorically, the spiritual heart, which could be God, it could be loving awareness. We all know it's love because throughout everything, that's the one thing that stands up is love. Even your mother, at that moment of telling you, you know, she was disappointed or whatever her words did or didn't say, that's love in her language. And it could be in a lot of other people's language. So I guess what my point is that if we open ourselves to the duality that's present and that you do not know it all, we actually don't know a hell of a lot more than everybody's walking around saying they know. And you can't stand in the witness and claim you know, because all the witness does is notice. Ah, there's anger. Ah, there's the small self. It doesn't ever associate with my or I, because it's just reporting. It's not wrapped up in it.
It's observing, yeah.
It's observing, and I think that's really important to say, because otherwise self-inquiry can feel like the mind judging the mind or controlling the mind or grasping the mind, and then you're in that vicious circle of the mind looking at the mind, looking at the mind, looking at the mind, looking at the mind, until you're like, I have no idea where I am or who I am. I find it helpful to look at the metaphorical heart space or whatever language makes you feel comfortable. So I think cultivating the witness lends a really helping, comfortable hand in that process. Do you find that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I had that language for it at first. As you were talking about life and death, I looked up something real quick, and chapter 7 of the Tao Te Ching has a line that says, it was never born, thus it can never die.
That's right.
I noticed as you were telling that story that I don't know if I'm living or dying. That's because right. I need a future or a past to do it.
That's right. You got it.
So,
how do we know that being born isn't the process of dying only?
You know, I mean, being born, though, itself is just another thought. That's you know, right. So I just kind of, you know, the thing I liked that Byron Katie, that I learned from Byron Katie was she says, teachers have no fun. Now, I'll identify myself as a teacher in business. That's a role I will step into. But she says, teachers have no fun. I prefer the role of student.
Absolutely.
And I've been passing that on to my clients, because it's like, from the position of student, you are kind of a manifestation of that, of the witness you're describing. You're just listening, you're observing, you're doing less interpreting and judging, you know, you're just witnessing. So
you're not taking it so personally, so you can talk about your vulnerabilities, because it's not so personal.
Yeah, it's not personal at all. It's, yeah, but everybody's got it. And I remember a neighbor of mine years ago worked in a Waldorf school. And I don't know a lot about Waldorf, but what he told me was that they would have exercises like give children a bucket and tell them to find like a million uses for that bucket. So it's not a bucket anymore.
Wow.
You can stand on it. You can wear it as a hat. You can, you know, all these different things. So like the label we gave it isn't necessarily true. I'm not really a gay man. I don't identify that way in my everyday life. If somebody says, do you want to go to a gay club? Then I'll step into that role for a moment to answer the question.
That's a beautiful way of putting it, Brian.
But I'm not a gay man. I'm just noticing that I tend to sleep with men.
That's right.
I tend to date guys. I tend to, you know, be attracted to them. But the whole, I think a lot of the problem with the gay community is that people feel like they have to latch onto this role.
Same with spirituality.
Yeah. And so we go around defining ourselves through this one. Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's almost like this is what defines me. It's like we found the holy grail of what defines you by these five traits.
Right.
You know, I'm a banker and I'm gay and like we have these little roles that never mind the male, female, mother, father, sister, brother roles and everything else we play.
Yeah.
We get caught up in these little roles. And so, you know, in my business, I help people overcome what I call a fog or a fear of greatness, the acronym of fear of greatness. And I see that when you define yourself in any of these little roles, you're smaller than you really are. You know, like every story leads away from you. Every story is taking you into this role
You're quoting very ancient Eastern teachings right now. That's absolutely.
Oh, am I? Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'm so feeling what you're saying. I'm sorry. I get excited when I hear it put in that way, because you're making it so much simpler than my mind tends to make it. You're making it so simple, because what Byron Katie's saying is the minute, because of our belief of what a teacher is, if you take on that role, which, I mean, Ram Dass has said a million times, if you take on that role, you're walking around as a teacher, and that is very serious. And you stop playing. And yes. Leela, the Sanskrit word for play, is such a fantastic word to incorporate into our human life, because when we're in the ego mind, it's very hard to laugh at ourselves or laugh at our predicament. We find it easier to laugh at others. Really, our laughing at others is really trying to find, our heart is trying to find our way through life with a little bit of humor. And you've been in my course, so humor is such a big part of it, because I think that it allows the mind to just go, you'll be all right. Let's just laugh, and the defenses don't need to be as high as they were. And the minute you can, if you're going to have to take any role, take the role of student. Even if you are a teacher on a business card, be that teacher as the student. And then you can play in the roles of gay guy, of mindset coach, of a man, of a banker, of a singer. For me, now looking back, as I had said earlier, I never left singing. It's just this, it's the belief system that being a singer means that you're supposed to be doing it right now on tour and making records, at least in my life. For other people, it might be singing cover gigs or singing commercials or, you know, whatever it is that defines that. But the minute that the play is out of it, it's all so serious. And that's when the spacesuit, it feels like one of those vacuum bags, you know, you put your clothes in and it goes and sucks all the air out. And there you are. I'm a singer. Oh, everything's really tight. I'm a singer. Yeah, I'm Katrina, the spiritual person. So I love what Byron Katie, her way of putting it, whatever role you're playing out there, no matter what it is, be the student of it. Be the student of the banker, the student of a mother, the student of a child, the student of a gay person. Because yes, your community, which you're not saying is your community, but the community of the gay community, the community of spirituality, yoga, is shockingly not very warm at all. But not so shockingly, because they're possibly needing to get stuck in that model till they get to a place where maybe that spacesuit is too tight. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's perfectly fine. For me, it was immediately obvious to me that I was going from one role and model to another role and model, that I just did not fit in. I just didn't fit in. And I didn't know that from a spiritual place. I more knew it from my actions. They were speaking for me. My actions of not wanting to work in a studio, my actions of not wanting to be too asana-based, my actions of saying, I don't want to teach, because you know what? My heart doesn't feel like it's teaching. I'm just being and I'm sharing. And that's really great for me to be a student in that, because that's so much lighter than strapping on this thing. I have a couple of questions before we go, though.
Oh, sure.
These are the questions that were sent in. I think some of them might have been already answered. This person is Karen from Wisconsin, says, what age did he know he was gay? Did he show gay tendencies as a kid? Now, we figured, we already talked about what age you were, so you'll have to rewind.
Yeah. Hi, Karen. So gay tendencies is a funny thing for me. That would be in the eye of the beholder, I think.
Absolutely.
But I wasn't effeminate or anything. I don't think I was obviously gay. Even today, I don't know. Some people tell me they have no idea. Some people, I don't know. I feel more free around it, so I don't really measure it like I used to.
Yeah.
But it's...
That's a great lesson for all of us, for Karen, you know, just to see that that's, that question alone is making gay.
I did have gay tendencies, actually. I liked musicals.
Did you?
So if, I'm just saying, like, that's what I mean, like, gay tendencies.
You know, right.
Did I eat Skittles, either a rainbow color. I mean, like, what's a gay tendency?
I know.
And that's where we get caught up. So internally, there was a lot going on, but I didn't have the words, or didn't, I was in denial of it.
Yeah.
But the tendencies, I would say what you might call the tendencies were just my normal.
Right.
You know, I didn't have a judgment of that.
And just because statistics will show something doesn't mean that if you're listening to this and you're young, that you should start looking for gay tendencies in yourself. Not everybody shows up in the same way unless mm-hmm. you are signing on the dotted line that everybody is the same.
I mean, I listen to Madonna and Nirvana.
You're so gay.
But Nirvana is like the opposite. So, you know, like, I don't know.
Right. What. No, I hope that actually cements what you and I have been talking about even more, that it's not really about the tendencies. It's about who's asking.
I was a fish in water without knowing I was in water.
Exactly. That's that story.
How it felt to grow up that way. I didn't know it was wrong or right. It was just how I was. And, you know, you mentioned how seriousness is. And sometimes I think back about at what age was I that I lost that childlike playfulness? Or it emerged in, you know, maybe in school when I was in college or really studying something that I got excited about, I would play there.
Right.
But generally, we shed the ability to play when, like, adulthood, if you want to look at it, is really here's your package of belief systems.
Yep.
And you should buy into these to join the club, or
yeah.
else you're
That's
immature.
Right.
Or we call you a name of some sort to degrade you. You
right.
know, and that's, adulthood is really signing your soul over to seriousness, I think. And
if you're prescribing, yeah. I mean, I like the astronomic stages, the four stages of life, where at the last stage, you retreat back into the forest. And I feel like that's speaking to what you're saying, because it's saying, okay, you built up your roles, your models, you got your beliefs, now leave him and go back into the forest and live out your years.
Yeah.
And leave them in the town, leave them in the village. Everything about aging sets it up for that. We start to lose our hearing, we start to lose our eyesight, start to lose our memory. It's actually trying to help us.
I think that's funny, because a lot of people in my family, you know, I've got some relatives with memory issues, young and old, and my grandmother's going through dementia right now, off and on, and doesn't even recognize her own child who's taking care of her. And yet the next day she's completely fine. And I have a cousin who has memory issues due to an accident she was in. And it's interesting because, you know, memory's a funny thing. I don't want to get too segued here, sidetracked. Memory is a funny thing to me because it's just a thought appearing now.
We can do a whole
and we call
podcast
it memory.
On memory. I mean, I've got some great stuff on memory. I would love to do that. We should do that.
We should talk later. Yeah,
yeah,
but
we
memory
should do that.
It's just a, you know, it's like you're using what's unreal to prove you have a problem. Like, you should have been able to think of that. You know?
Yeah.
So what's wrong with you? Right. You can't think of what you're not thinking about?
Like, right? we need more to fix something. Like, we need more pressure. We don't have enough. The next one was from Janine in New York. Do you think a person is born gay, or do they develop a preference over time? It's almost like a whine.
Yeah, I think the preference idea is what most people see, though. You know, like, whenever I came out, that's what it was like. It was a gay preference, is what everybody called it, you know, 20 years ago. And it's funny to me because, you know, I didn't like check a box or something. I didn't, no one asked me to make a big decision. I just lived my life. And so really, you know, it's your preference to see it that way.
Do you think I may just be ignorant, so I'm saying this completely from an ignorant place, but are there really people out there that are thinking that people who are gay are wanting to make life harder or piss people off or be different?
That's part I never quite understood. But I think it goes back to what you said earlier about we want to control the uncontrollable. And so we therefore project that onto others. Well, you must have control. You know, what's wrong with you? I took my straight pills this morning.
Right.
You know, it's like...
That's a great awareness for me. Yeah. Right. Like, I can control this. Why can't you control that?
What's wrong with you?
It's not acceptable. But I would love to walk and be a fly on the wall in some of their homes, because if they're, like, say, having an issue with food, and they're not supposed to eat something, and they go in the freezer to get it, and they eat it, I would be right there to say, you should control that. And you can't control that.
That's what I learned the language for recently is it's our subconscious thoughts that are basically running things. And our conscious mind will say, oh, well, you should be able to control this.
Right.
But there's something way deeper that says something else, and that's what we're responding to. So if you don't surface, if you don't bring that to the light of awareness, then you're still being guided by it, but you don't know who's the puppeteer, if you will.
Yeah.
Like you're just doing stuff, and that's still how it is.
Yep.
Actually, it's hard to talk about it because it's still how it is.
Yeah.
I just don't. I don't worry about the puppeteer, I guess. But it's in terms of like this whole preference thing. It's like it's not like chocolate or vanilla ice cream.
So you feel you're born.
Even a preference, though. Even a preference. Where did you get your preference? Even if it were a preference.
Yeah, it's interesting that we never ask.
Why do you prefer vanilla, not chocolate?
Well, why do I prefer men? It's interesting that because it's socially acceptable, I've never actually asked myself that question.
Yeah, a lot of straight people, because of that reason, do not investigate their own self. And if they did, they'd understand me better. They'd understand other people that are different better. Because...
Right.
If they really considered it, you know, you didn't ever make a decision in that.
Right.
If anything, and I can only speak for myself, but I may be speaking for a lot of gay people, when you're feeling ostracized like that, you want anything to fit in. More than anything, you want to be... Back then, I would have taken a straight pill.
Wow, Brian, that's really profound.
When I came out, I didn't want the straight pill.
Right, so it was living the lie.
I'd call it the crazy pill. But at the time when I, you know, so the whole preference thing was funny to me at the time, funny in a strange way, because I didn't understand that thinking. I could sit with it and make some sense out of it, but to really understand, you know, that's a person who is very concerned about approval. That's a person who is very concerned about how other people see them. And, you know, what I learned from the work is that everybody is a mirror for me. So you could say something about gay people that you don't like. Like, gay people are promiscuous, let's say. And when you do that, when you work through that thought, you discover your promiscuity. Not just your, you may be a virgin, but you fantasize all the time. Or you imagine gay sex.
Yep.
Now who's gay?
Yeah.
You're the one in the bedroom imagining the gay sex. That's what's funny to me is that people, they'll have judgments about this or that being disgusting or whatever it is, but they're the one imagining it. So don't knock it till you try it, but you're the one imagining it.
Right.
You're the one having gay sex in your straight mind.
Yeah.
And even if you say, the gay people are gay because of a preference, then that still reflects back on you. Maybe you're not gay, but what other ways are you guiding yourself by preferences or defining your life by your preferences?
That's a great place for people to go from there. Absolutely. And so you're basically saying you believe that it is not a choice.
It wasn't a choice I made.
Right. And that might not be the same for other people.
It might not be, but I've never met someone who told me they chose it.
Interesting. That's great.
I've met people who came out really late, but when you talk to them, most of the people, I can only speak for the people I've spoken to, but they'll tell you a lot of it was social stuff. A lot of it was social. It was socially unacceptable. And so they stayed in the closet. I have friends in their mid to late 40s who today are still in the closet to their parents.
Wow.
And, you know, if they could choose, maybe they would, but...
Maybe they wouldn't.
Maybe
it's not any of their parents' business.
That's what some of them tell me. It's just like, well, my sex life, we don't live near each other, and my sex and romantic life is just private, and they keep it that way. But they wouldn't keep it that way if they didn't have fear.
Right. Well, or you know, like, if it's creating suffering for them, I think that should be the indicator. And I'm not saying run away from something that's creating suffering, because it could be based on a fear.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of factors in there, because always being honest with somebody, like maybe his parents are older and it would really destroy them at this point. Maybe, you know, you got to take a lot of things into consideration before feeling like doing one thing in every situation is the right thing.
Well, here's what I just heard you say. So, with you know, let's say that I'm in my late 60s, early 70s, and my child tells me that they're coming out to me, and if I have a problem with that, I had the problem before they told me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my child did not cause my problem.
That's right.
They just reminded me, if anything.
That's right.
And I used to tell people, so I do a local meetup group, and I would tell people that came, I would use the example, I'd say, like, Katrina, you are such a tree. And it's laughable, it's ridiculous. But if I say, you are so unfaithful, or you are a bad mom, that would...
Yeah,
I'm lucky I didn't get hit, but but I would ask those people, what was the difference between those two labels? Why doesn't tree hurt and the other one does?
Because I don't have a belief system.
You don't believe you're a tree.
No, exactly.
But if you tap into a memory of being a bad mom or being a bad girlfriend or anything like that, then that's what you do. But what happens in the moment is you blame me for hurting you.
That's right. That's right.
You don't take any personal responsibility.
None.
For it. And the work is not for everybody. The work is a way to take personal responsibility through that awareness. And once you're aware that you're in the matrix, you can't go back consciously.
No, you can't. Once you know you don't know, you can't undo that. And yeah, that's exactly what this practice is about, is like taking personal responsibility and through that, you learn to find self-compassion and compassion for others, to where it doesn't matter if I don't want to have gay sex. I wouldn't want to do anything to create violence on you because you are. And it's like we're a compassionless culture, and we think compassion is about pity or,
That's another podcast, isn't it?
And I just think that if we could actually remember a time, you may not understand Brian's story, but if you widen your lens and you hear what Brian's really saying, he's saying that he felt like he didn't belong. And I would beg anybody out there to tell me that there is not a time in your life at some point that you have not felt like you do not belong. And if you can close your eyes and put yourself back at that time when you felt like you didn't belong and allow those feelings to bubble up, and place yourself in that present moment, knowing that you're safe because you're not there right this second, but you have that power in your mind. That's why we have this mind. It's incredible to be able to put ourselves back in that situation. And you feel what that felt like. And that was just a moment for you. Maybe you live with it. But for those who are not living with not feeling like you don't belong or feeling like you're doing something that's shunned or that's going to make you go to hell or that's disgusting or dirty or whatever else it is that you've felt, if you could take that little moment that you felt that and magnify it over an entire lifetime for some people who are dealing with being homosexual, gay, lesbian, alternative lifestyle, transgender, you name it. Just for a second, imagine feeling like you do not belong and being told by all mass media and all religions that you're, not all religions, but most of the major religions, that you're, something is wrong with you. Go into that well, because that's compassion. And that takes balls. It takes balls to be able to put yourself in a vulnerable position and going back into your memory, just feeling sorry for people and giving them your personal verdict of hell and damnation. I got news for you. That's really not going to change them. Not that anything would, but it's definitely that is not going to change somebody. All that's going to do is put somebody's defenses up.
That you're describing my relationship with my mother about a decade ago.
Wow, Brian, I stand in total honor of you bringing this out, to being able to talk about it with us, educating, and just being willing to stand in that place. I can see your face, they can't, but I can see your face at times even talking about it. Even though it's not a role and a model you're living in right now, that is our unique gift as humans, other than a cat, you know, or a squirrel. We have this cognitive mind that gives us the ability to look back in at our thoughts. And it is the wise that are able to use those experiences to tap into that well, to give that compassion to other people. So you may not be gay, but this whole podcast is not about being gay. It may seem like that, but as Kate has said, it's just the form of transportation right now, because it's really about not feeling like you belong, lacking self-confidence, fear, criticism, rejection, and being able to use spirituality, religion, scripture, alternative thinking, and Byron Katie's The Work, which is what Brian specializes in. I'm going to tell you how to get in touch with Brian, because this is what Brian does. He can help walk you through the Byron Katie, The Work, in a really beautiful, holding space for all sorts kind of way. And I can speak to that from experience, because after he was in Zooming in the Lens, like I said, he let me sample The Work, And he really is a student of life, as I hope that I am. Well, I feel I am, but I'm hoping that you also feel that I am always coming from that space. So I will tell you how to get in touch with him, just so you can learn more, so you can ask him any questions about it and about Byron Katie, but just about his, how he transformed these feelings to fuel his practice. Now, had he not had any of these experiences, there would be a different person sitting in front of us. We all have them. They're just titled under different belief systems and topics. But think broader. Imagine that tree in your wall is a tree and not just wood. That's the kind of widening that I think, listen, when you're not worried about getting to an end result, it's not you're not questioning to get somewhere. You're not questioning because your mind will say to you, what's the purpose? What does it matter? I'm never going to know anyway. Well, then I'll say that to you when you make up the next story about why he didn't call you, or why you didn't get that job, or why your car broke down. You're fine with all those stories. So why not add some stories into your mind that you also don't know and might never know to be true? Because it's just creating the mundane to be extraordinary. Everybody has wood. Everybody has the ability to pontificate and use the stories and the ability of the mind that we have for purposes that are creating other parts of you. Unzip the spacesuit and surprise, the secret has been hidden in plain sight the entire time. We're all looking outside for a system and a model. I find a lot of worth in those systems and models, but the really good ones are just pointing the finger back at you to, yes, I say have a little balls, softly, nicely, and realize that that mirror is being held up for us to venture into the parts of us that they're going to be there, and you're going to want them there louder as the end of life, whenever that is, comes for all of us. Everybody wants to have dialogue about it.
Yeah.
They just don't want to maybe do it publicly, or they're embarrassed, or whatever it is. And I really honor that we're all able to show up in that kind of place, because I think not talking about this stuff is just fueling other people's beliefs when it doesn't really serve us. And I think all these questions are really thoughtful, you know, in their honesty and their vulnerability with it.
You reminded me briefly of something Ram Dass talks about with aging and, you know, spray painting the leaves green.
Right. Like, how dare you, leaves fall? You should never fall. You should never change. What's wrong with you? But yeah, his point in that was like, we don't judge trees. We just go, wow, that's a color green. That's a this. That's a pretty tree. That's a not so pretty tree, whatever. We just are so much nicer to vegetation. And if we could just learn to be that way with ourselves and accept that the tree's leaves, four seasons, they change. And we're accepting of that. We don't yell at the tree for the leaf falling when winter's coming. And why do we look at aging as so bad? Why is everybody trying to stay the same? Don't we realize that that's like that's the gift of it? Is that nothing ever stays the same?
That's funny, because I love the Tao Te Ching. And there's a part of chapter 74 that says, if you realize that all things change, there's nothing you will try to hold on to.
That's a beautiful, beautiful quote and a perfect place to end it. Because we could go on forever. Obviously, this is going to be a part one and part two. That is already known. It's going to be a part one and part two. So I don't know where I'll split it, but I will. And so listen, here's what I want to give you, the information about Brian. So Brian Clark is his name. It's spelled B-R-Y-A-N, Clark, C-L-A-R-K. And it is Friendly, Friendly, hyphen, universe.com. Friendly-universe.com. He does Skypes, he does phones, he does in person. He's right now in Colorado, right? Yes. Yeah. He's right now in Colorado. And if you're interested in anything for him, you could just email him directly. I am just standing in an utter place of gratefulness that you would talk to us about all of this stuff that has brought you to being able to accept the work and spiritual practices like we shared together, Zooming in the Lens. You were such a huge asset and continue to be in our satsang. And I would love to do it again with you and talk more, because I think your perspective is one that just brings with it a lot of wisdom and a lot of humility and a lot of humbleness. And I really honor that, Brian. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Katrina. And I appreciate you opening up the dialogue for this, because it's something my younger self would have been terrified to do. And so it was a growing experience for me just to be on this podcast with you. And also, you know, those questions that people submitted, those are very popular questions. One thing I love that Katie says is there are no new stressful thoughts. They're all recycled. And these are not things I've never heard before. But they are things people are afraid to ask. So thank you for creating a space to have this. I think when we, our gaps of ignorance are often filled with fear. And so this is a, you know, tightening that gap a little.
Yeah. I feel that in myself, just knowing you, just being able to have this dialogue with you. Do you have anything you could recommend for anybody to read or watch a video or anything? Like, if there's anybody out there.
I'm a little out of touch. Well, for the Byron Katie stuff, I'll say her first book, Loving What is a great place to start. If you go to thework.com, there's also some really great, everything on there is pretty much free except for the events. As far as coming out, you know, at the time I came out, I talked to PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, or I would look at the Human Rights Campaign maybe to get some other resources. I'm out of touch with more specific researchers because I think a lot of millennials and things like that are, people like that are not having the torturers up, you know, going through culture the way I did. It wasn't always torturous, but just that I don't fit in kind of thing.
Yeah, which I think we all identify with, whether you're gay or not.
In one way or another. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But I don't really know. There's definitely local, you know, gay and lesbian centers in most major cities, too, that if you just wanted to educate yourself or to understand gay people or to volunteer or to do something really just to educate yourself to get out there. I actually, at Byron and Katie's School for the Work, the first one I went 2 years ago, we had this exercise where we were doing this exercise on the opposite sex, and somebody raised their hand and said they were a lesbian, and what do I do? And so she said, well, write about whoever makes sense for you. And I did not end up writing about gay men. I ended up writing about straight men and the fears I had around them. And that was a cathartic moment, because just when I thought we were going to lunch, Katie handed me the microphone because I asked her a question. So I had to read this worksheet to a group of mostly straight men, and they had to listen to every sentence I said and say thank you.
Wow.
So that was an intense moment. Got a lot of hugs. A lot of homophobic people in that two-week period came up and just said that their life had changed that week. They wanted to hug all the gay people there and all this stuff. So it was,
wow.
It was really, you know, I had a lot of fears around straight men and intimidation around that. And there's still remnants of that left, but most of that's gone. But it was very fearful. I think I had that at age in fifth grade, even, you know, just afraid to not fitting in with the guys. And
yeah.
So, you know, it's great to close the gap of these misunderstandings, because that's really all they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you are being bullied and you're young, even if you're old, whatever. But if you are being bullied because you're different, I really hope for you that you can reach out to somebody that you feel safe with and tell them. Because there's nothing more unfair than being bullied if you're different. I'm not even talking about just being gay. Just being bullied in general for being different.
If I may, too, if it's not inappropriate here, I have a 13-year-old client who wrote a book on overcoming bullying.
Oh, please. And
it's just coming out, like, in the next month or two.
Oh, plug it.
I will plug this here. It's her name is Kate Dillette, and the book is called... you can go to her website, actually, and read all about it. It's Allie, A-L-L-Y, thebrave.com. So Allie the Brave. And you can find out more about her book there, which will be coming out soon. And, you know, she's definitely, it's just bullying in school. You know, she's a 13-year-old girl and sees her friends going through bullying. And her mom, actually, is a friend of mine who I went to the first Byron Katie school and met her there, actually. So that's part of this is her upbringing was her mom doing the work, too. So so it's kind of an effect of that. But, yeah, it's great to see someone that young.
Oh, I love that.
Combat bullying, so.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That's great. Brian, thank you so much. And we'll do it again. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Zooming in the Lens. You can find out more about us at functionalyogaonline.com. And we will see you next time. Bye, Brian.
Bye. Thanks, Katrina.
And a big thank you to you for tuning in to Zooming in the Lens podcast, where you're letting us all practice, and hopefully we're allowing you to practice with us. If you'd like more information on Brian Clark, go to clientclarity.com. For more information on me, Katrina, and Zooming in the Lens, go to functionalyogaonline.com. And make sure you check out the latest group forming on functionalyogaonline.com. For Zooming in the Lens online course. Take care and see you next time.
And Elizabeth Lesser, who is the author of The Seeker's Guide and Broken Open. She also co-founded the Omega Institute. And the Reverend Ed Bacon, who is rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, who doesn't have a book, but welcome.
Yes. I read their book.
You read their book. Reverend Ed, we're going to start with you. Let's define spirituality. Go ahead. Tell us what you think it means.
Well, I agree with you about connection. It is about our being connected with one another and being connected with the cosmos. It is the process of being healed, forgiven, empowered to go into the world to be fully alive. But for me, the key to that, the doorway to that, is having an experience of being unconditionally and fully loved.
Elizabeth, your definition?
To me, spirituality is, it's an instinct. Like we have an instinct to go to sleep, to drink water, to eat. There's this instinct inside of each and every one of us that there's more to life than meets the eye. There's something greater out there than our daily grind. And spirituality is the fearlessness to look at that something else. What is it? It's the fearlessness to ask the big questions. Who am I? What's my purpose in life? Where do we go when we die? And how do we live a fully alive, meaningful, giving, generous life when we're here?
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.